Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
We go to California and Bill Gross. Bill, good morning.
Hi, Tom.
David Malpass just giving a massive shout out to you and the PIMCO troops on getting the new normal right. This is a new normal report, isn't it?
Oh, I think for sure. You know, the household survey with the participation rate at 63.2 is probably a little better than the payrolls, but the payrolls, like you mentioned, in terms of a three-month moving average around 145,000. I would mention that since 2011, it's averaged closer to 200,000. And what has that produced in terms of a nominal GDP growth? About 3.5%, and in terms of real, about 2%. And so if we can only produce jobs at 145 with flat wages or 0.1% increase in wages, then there's not much room for more than a 2% growth.
I want to go within this jobs report, folks, and the dated nature of it. Futures up 5. Bill Gross, a 10-year yield comes in. Now, just to reframe this, folks, you remember the hysteria. Bill Gross was down in the mailroom. He started in the mailroom at PIMCO. He was there in August opening envelopes, helping them with those net outflows. Bill, you've had a better bond market recently, lower yields, higher prices, but is that a good sign for the economy?
Well, I don't think so. You know, it certainly is for housing, let's put it that way. And that was one of the things that the Fed was concerned about in terms of the, you know, the penalty that high mortgage rates, 4.5%, were exacting on the housing market and the household purchases for, you know, homes. But, you know, I think ultimately that low rates, you know, carry a burden. They carry a penalty because they, in fact, lower the return on investment for corporations and make them, you know, non-willing to basically extend risk into the real economy.
I mean, you had to put money where mouth is with a yield at 3% or above that and a hysteria of going higher. Michael Feroli at J.P. Morgan, I thought, had a terrific note in the hysteria looking for lower yields. How much lower can yields drive? What is your framework of where the 10-year can go given this American economy and this jobs report?
Well, I don't think much. You know, I want to maintain a bullish outlook on the bond market and suggest that yields aren't headed higher, certainly in the face of this report. But, you know, let's go back and use the 5-year at 65 basis points and the 10-year at 1.65 or 1.7 at the bottom. You know, can we approach those levels? You know, I think with very much difficulty, because investors remember what happened when we did. And investors know, even at the moment, at 260 or 255 for the 10-year, that those are artificially suppressed yields. And so we will grudgingly go lower from this point, but I don't think there's much impetus in terms of moving higher. And I think a bond investor can earn the coupon and maybe get a little capital gain as well.
We'll come back with Bill Gross on the bond portfolio. Let's stay with jobs right now. Bill Gross, I look at the jobs report today. It's more of the same. 2-year yield now, folks, under 0.30 to 4 digits, 0.2986. How do we create more jobs, Bill, from your vista, with your work with the CFA Institute, with your bond portfolio work? How does this nation create jobs?
Well, let's look at the problems. You know, first of all, from a structural standpoint, I've said it before on this program many times. You know, they come from delevering on a global basis. It comes from re-regulation. We're seeing that with the banks, and it comes, you know, certainly in terms of deglobalization, where we're pulling in terms of trade. And so all of those structural forces suggest that jobs will be harder to create going forward. How do we create what we can create on a cyclical basis? I think it takes the fiscal as opposed to the monetary side. You know, there's been exasperation from Bernanke and now from Janet Yellen, I'm sure, in the future as to why the fiscal side isn't pulling their own weight. And for them, that basically means spending some money. Yeah. I know that's not the Republican view, but, you know, the fiscal deficit basically has to be 4 to 5% at least, and it has to be, employed productively in order to make sense.
Bill, there is one big interdependency. What is the price for our lousy job economy for someone like Europe?
Well, the price is a higher euro, which exacts a price in terms of their exports and slows their own economy. You know, the U.S. trade-weighted dollar, Tom, since 2000, and that goes back 10 plus years, has declined by over 20%, and it's moving lower now. And so the dollar, based on its monetary policy and its QEs, has really weakened its currency and benefited its own manufacturing export sector. Euroland does not have that.
Well, let me ask you this. Right now, we've got the dollar, as Tom says, 137, 10-year yield down to 253. How much of this is the one-day knee-jerk reaction? I mean, where will we settle out under these economic conditions?
Well, I think, Mike, that we settle out based upon expectations for the policy rate. I know the taper is in focus, and we probably won't be tapering anytime soon, and so it's difficult to measure. But I think ultimately that Yellen's model, which is based on what she calls optimal control and the Taylor 99 model in combination, all of which provides flexibility around an inflation rate and an unemployment rate at 6.5%. I'm going on too long to answer your question.
No, it's fine.
But basically, if the policy rate stays where it is until 2016, based on these types of numbers, then the five-year, it's probably now at, 128 or 29, belongs somewhere in the 120 to 130 range. I don't think it's going back to where it was. And the 10-year probably belongs around, 2.5%. Both of those yields are artificially suppressed, and that, brings the danger of at some point, if the rest of the world or if creditors, revolt and basically start selling treasuries based on the suppressed yields, that, some negative things could happen. But I think the 10-year at 250 belongs where it is at the moment.
Mike, I know you want to jump in here. May I just say, looking at the probability of where interest rates will be, we are out to Mr. Gross's 2016. I mean, it's just amazing how we've moved beyond next year and into 2015 and maybe into 2016. I find that amazing.
Well, Bill, are you buying 2016? Are we going to have to wait that long to see the economy improve?
Well, hey, here's what you want to buy. I mean, we have the most confidence, yes, in 2016 and Janet Yellen's dovishness and our new model, et cetera, and, of course, the weakness of the economy that we see today. And so you put all that together, and it suggests, yes, policy rates, static until at least 2016. And so what do you buy? You buy, in a complicated way, you buy Eurodollar futures, the greens, the blues, the 2015-2016 policy rate, types of vehicles that are underpriced at the moment. And you buy 5 years, and you buy 6 years, and you buy 7 years, and you look for a steepening curve as opposed to buying 30 years, because Yellen is really reflating or trying to reflate, and that's
right.
A negative for 30s and a very much of a positive for anything between 0 and 5.
Bill, you made headlines with us years ago by suggesting the interest rate play shares of Procter & Gamble. Is the yield total return now still in dividend growth, or can you find it in the fixed income space?
Well, it is in dividend growth, and it is importantly, Tom, in share buyback. Procter has a big share buyback program, too, and in combination with that 2.5% yield, probably they produce 4 to 5% of total yield from the standpoint of earnings per share growth from share buybacks and dividends. So, there is a definite advantage as long as the U.S. and global economy, continue on at a 2% growth rate or so, that that shares relative to bonds are benefiting and will continue to benefit.
I mean, I look at average shares, look at CSX. I talked to their president the other day, and the share buybacks, the number of weighted average shares of CSX is 25% from where it was like 5 or 6 years ago. It's one big share buyback, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And there's a large company, I won't mention the name, a large industrial and financial company. I'm going to write about it in my investment outlook in a week. Basically hasn't grown the top line by more than 1% over the past 10 years, but has grown earnings per share by a good 10 to 15% through share buybacks and cutting expenses. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of not of top line growth, but of bottom line earnings per share growth through share buybacks and other expense cutting measures.
Well, it raises a question. Why do we see the labor market that we are seeing, the lack of hiring growth? Is it the uncertainty everybody talks about with one crisis or another following? Or is it that now we've got this compensation set up where companies are rewarded for short-term profit gains and company executives. And so the focus is on companies like the one you're talking about, always controlling the bottom line, not worrying as much about the top line.
Yeah, I think, Mike, that is a problem. I mean, it's increasingly being picked up by the press and yourself, you know, to the extent that the compensation based on earnings per share and stock price, you know, propels CEOs and executives to continue to cut and to, you know, to force wages down to a certain floor, then yes, that's a big part of the problem.
So if I could just follow, Tom,
please.
Does that change once we get past, in other words, does the labor market outlook change once we get past whatever's happening in Washington when we get into 2014? Or does this sort of muddling along continue because companies aren't being forced to hire, don't really care?
Yeah, I don't know what changes it, Mike, because you know, deglobalization and the global economy itself is exerting a downward, you know, push on wages. Wages as a percentage of GDP has gone down from 59% to 54%. Corporate profits have gone the other way. And so, what changes that? At what point does the 99 revolt, and or at what point does the 99, in terms of their, you know, their savings rate and their total spending power, you know, does it become exhausted and give a message to corporations that they simply can't continue doing what they're doing?
But, Bill, the heart of this matter, and you quote in your wonderful note Ray Dalio, the legendary hedge fund guy. Good morning, Ray, if you're listening, as I know you do. And you say, you use the massive, fancy economic phrase, how much wood can a woodchuck chuck? and within that, it's how much can the haves get before society just says no? Are we there?
I don't think so, but we should be getting there. You know, at some point, aside from our Sunday football and our you know, Saturday college sports, you know, the 99 should basically wake up and smell the you know, the low wages, so to speak, and you know, produce some type of revolt. We've seen that, I guess, with McDonald's and in some other cases where they simply say, hell no, we won't go. They did go back, but you know, at some point, labor versus capital is the you know, the future battleground for the United States.
Yeah.
And perhaps even the global economy.
Well, and the place I would disagree, and I'd love your perspective on this, Bill, you say the 1%. Far more importantly, is it the 10 or the 15% and the other 85%? Do we have to go to 1%?
Well, no. But you know, importantly, the 1% in terms of a percentage of nominal income has garnered an increasing,
yes,
and gargantuan proportion of national income. And so we certainly start with the 1% and we go down,
right,
to the other 14.
I have one more question very quickly, Bill. You are a stamp collector, official surveillance stamp collector. And folks, Mr. Gross has donated thousands, if not millions, to charity through his numismatic abilities. How much do you hate the stamps that have no number on them? They're just stamps. They're just
forever stamps.
Forever stamps. Yeah.
Well, they're not collectible, Tom.
They're not
right?
Collectible.
You want forever bonds?
I hate them with a passion. No, you can't collect a stamp without a number on it. And in case of collecting, you basically have to collect a stamp in the 20th century as opposed to
very good. Bill Gross.
Bloomberg Surveillance, weekday mornings at 7 Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Channel 119. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.